business meeting of the Judicial Council of California for August 2011. Thank you all for being here. I want to begin by calling our attention to the amended agenda that we'll get to in a few moments. As you know, if you look on the amended agenda you just received, the Bar Association of San Francisco has a request to amend Rule 10.815, and there will be more information on this later, but the summary is the item would establish a new fee in complex civil cases. It was added to the agenda earlier this week at the request of the Bar and in consideration of the current financial situation of the San Francisco Superior Court. Before we move on further to our public comment, I want to point out again, as I always do, that our business meetings are audiocast live and are also archived and are available on the California Court website. As a result, I ask everyone to please turn off their phones and speak into the microphones directly. And when you remember, please try to identify yourself before speaking, or when speaking to another council member, please refer to the other council member by his or her name for those following on the live cast. Also, as you know, we tape portions of the meeting that are later broadcast on our website or for educational meetings. And, you know, for some of our meetings, we've had hundreds and hundreds of visitors online or later at the archive broadcasts. For this afternoon and our panels, we have several presenters who will identify themselves as the panel is produced and proceeds. I want to welcome, however, two incoming Judicial Council members whose terms will begin September 15, who are joining us for the first time. I believe we have here from the State Bar Ms. Angela Joy Davis of the Office of the United States Attorney General in Los Angeles. Welcome. And we had yesterday at our business meeting, but I believe he was unable to attend today, Mr. Mark Robinson of Robinson, Kalkaney et al. Of Newport Beach. Because of the complexity of the issues facing the Judicial Council and the judicial branch, and because of the interest and transparency that we have in our proceedings, Justice Miller, the chair of the Executive and Planning Committee, reviewed the changes and course of conduct in our meetings and has expanded our public comment period for up to 5 minutes per speaker at the beginning of our sessions. Part of the changes instituted by Judicial Council and led by Justice Miller was the opening to the public of our education and issues meeting yesterday, which I thought was very productive, put on by the judges, panels that if you're interested in, the agenda was posted on the website and can be accessed. But I'd like to get immediately to our list of public speakers. As I said earlier, part of our new process is to allow up to half an hour of our morning meeting devoted to comment by the public on a subject of their choosing relating to issues in front of the judicial branch or judicial council. Also, we've changed the agenda where speakers who want to speak to a specific agenda item would speak more closely in time to that agenda item. But this morning, regarding our new public comment period, we have six speakers. I will call them up to the podium in order of how they assign up to speak and remind them that they have up to 5 minutes. And I'll start, please, this morning with Mr. Stewart.
Is this position all right, Lady Chairperson?
Might be more comfortable for you to please step to the podium with a taller microphone. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Lady Chairperson and California Judicial Council members. It's an honor to address you, and I thank you for allowing me to speak. As you may know, in 2009, there were over 500,000 foreclosures in California. My talk coincides with a PowerPoint slide presentation that I submitted for this talk that all of you, I understand, have a copy of. It's regarding Judicial Council UD-100 form, intent versus use. And for all these talks, usually you give an outline of what you're going to say, then you say it, and then you give a conclusion and recap what you said. So I would open with a joke, but The one that I had is kind of corny, so I'll proceed to the outline. I'm going to contrast the unlimited jurisdiction complaint versus the unlawful detainer complaint, then go to the legislative report concerning the code passed by the legislature regarding unlawful detainer actions, the judicial council intent as inferred by the comments on the JD-100 form, the current use by attorneys for banks of the UD-100 form, and then overview how judges implement the UD complaint versus the intent of the complaint, and the civil rights and due process issues for homeowners who are confronted with a UD complaint. First of all, the ordinary unlawful or unlimited jurisdiction complaint is to be used only after administrative remedies have been exhausted for a party whose rights have been violated. The unlimited jurisdiction complaints have three full rounds of discovery prior to trial setting, and then another full round of discovery after trial setting, but before trial. The unlimited jurisdiction complaint allows for a cross-complaint that must be heard prior to the hearing of the complaint and that cannot be dismissed, unlike the complaint, pursuant to maxims of law. The unlawful detainer complaint does not allow for a cross-complaint. It is fast-tracked. It does not allow for full discovery. It operates under the presumption that the plaintiff, who's filing the unlawful detainer, has standing to file the unlawful detainer, and it does not allow a challenge to the ownership claim of the plaintiff or the standing of the plaintiff to file and make the claim for an unlawful detainer. The legislative report for the unlawful detainer legislation makes it clear that it is intended for non-payment of rent. That indicates that it's to be applied to renters, not homeowners who've been foreclosed upon. The Judicial Council on the UD-100 Judicial Council form states clearly on page one, note, do not use this form for evictions after sale. And then it cites Code of Civil Procedure Section 1161A. Now, the current use of the unlawful detainer complaint by the banks involves their deliberate misrepresentation of the owners who they have foreclosed upon as renters. And, of course, there's no opportunity in the unlawful detainer complaint to challenge this. The 99% of foreclosures are currently done in California in fraud. So we've got a situation where you've got a fraudulent complaint filed. Homeowners are confronted with this on a fast track, and generally they are confused and baffled, and they when they ask to change the jurisdiction from the limited jurisdiction unlawful detainer to a unlimited complaint with cross-complaint, as is provided generally by local rules, the judges generally refuse. And further, the judges do not do a sua sponte dismissal of the unlawful detainer for lack of standing.
Mr. Stewart?
Yes.
I believe you're up to your 5 minutes, but
I can conclude very quickly.
Within 30 seconds, please, sir.
The banks have no standing to foreclose because all of the notes for the mortgages are securitized. They're sealed in a 30-year REMIC, a real estate management investment conduit that the banks do not open because then they'll have to pay the taxes and penalties on $3.6 billion of REMIC notes, not just the note they're trying to get. So they never become an assign on the note. They never are recorded into the public record as an assign on the note. They've separated the note from the deed of trust, so they have violated UCC 3-305B and made the note unenforceable, but this standing is never allowed to be challenged. And furthermore, the trustee fraudulently certifies under penalty of perjury that Civil Code 2934 and all its requirements have been satisfied when, in fact, the California Civil Code 2932.5 has been violated because the banks never have the note.
Mr. Stewart, I'm going to stop you here because I want you to know we have an idea of this of the substance of your complaint about the use of this form, and we appreciate your bringing this attention to the Judicial Council. Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chairperson.
Thank you.
Chief Justice.
Thank you, sir. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Adrienne Williams. We'll pass Ms. Williams for the time being. And find, is Mr. Jose Rios Merida present?
Madam Chief Justice, honorable council members, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Good morning.
On July 22nd, members of my union local, SEIU Local 21, spoke before you, along with other service providers in the courts, to address our concerns about the priorities and allocation of the judicial branch budget. Appreciative not only of your time and of the monumental task before you, but also of the greater realities, economic realities, facing our state and our nation. And most importantly, of the mission of the courts to provide equal justice, equal access to justice in our state. We came right to the point, and we offered specific suggestions for your consideration. I'd like to repeat those to you today. They are termination of the Deloitte contract for a costly IT boondoggle. Termination of all further spending on a nearly $2 billion CCMS computer system experiment. Bringing extravagant courthouse construction projects in line with other state building projects. Transfer of construction projects to the more experienced California Department of General Services. Termination of pension giveaways to top executives. And further streamlining of a bloated and centralized bureaucracy here at the AOC. We were disappointed to learn that despite a nearly unanimous voice by the California trial courts and by service providers, our suggestions appear to have been ignored and that the Judicial Council had already made up their mind. So I'm here to suggest to you, I think some of you are judges, to please accept it from a court clerk who often on a daily basis stands between you and the many court users putting their lives before the court in the hallways and the attorneys and attorney services and paralegals that use our system. And we speak to them on an informal and more relaxed setting. So I'd like to suggest to you that there is at least an elephant in the room, that what we're hearing from the public and within our system is that there is a real, possibly visceral disconnect between the members of this council, some of you perhaps within the seemingly safety of the constitutionality of your offices, and the economic realities in California and facing the taxpayers. This actually transfers to us, the court service providers, when our resources are curtailed, when we are overburdened by the workload, less service providers, and dealing with the daily frustrations of the court. Therefore, I'll make it short. I came here to ask you to please reconsider our recommendations, and that before the day is over, that you please read again our mission statement to the California taxpayers, to the court users, and to make service and equal access to the California taxpayers the sole priority in allocating our budget. That is our sole purpose. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Mariva. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Timothy J. Lavarini.
Excuse me. Distinguished members of the AOC, Justices, Chief, my name is Timothy James Lavarini, and I am your clerk. I could be any clerk from any courtroom or any office in any of these great counties, 58 counties, that make up this golden state where I was born and can only hope now to continue to call home. Like many of my fellow clerks, the words unemployment and foreclosure have taken the place of to serve and uphold. Our stories are all much the same. We work hard, sometimes through our breaks and even through our lunch times and after work, without submitting overtime, just to make sure our judges will be well prepared, or to make sure that we can help out at the window for the bewildered public as they try to maneuver as frightened strangers in unfamiliar surroundings. My first exposure to the court was when I was a boy. I would accompany my late grandmother, private attorney Molly H. Manudry, to court, where I would help her carry her heavy briefcase when she filed some brief motions. She originally came from Shasta County to start off her legal career as a clerk. She then studied law, graduated second in her class as a grandmother, and went on to become the first female public defender in the city and county of San Francisco. She then went on to have her own practice, where she was known to say, "Everyone deserves their day in court." Though she loved a good argument, I think she would have to say that all of us are really on the same side of this issue, and that is to keep intact the good name of this state's judicial branch, while still not faltering in our duty to its citizens. As a boy, when I would join her in court, she would gently admonish me, "Timbo Jimbo, now sit up straight, don't chew gum, don't read your comic book, and don't speak unless the judge has spoken to you, because you must always show respect for the bench and to the judge." I remember asking her, "Is that because the judge is always right?" And she paused and said, "It's because the judge took an oath. That's a very special promise, to always do what's right." I later came to work for the courts in part because my father told me just before he died that I should get a government job, where if I worked long and hard, that I would have a secure future and a pension to rely on in my retirement. He feared that it didn't look like me or my partner were going to have any children to take care of us in our old age, as we were now doing for him after Mom died. Now, besides my job, which I've grown to love, as clerk of civil archives, it looks like even my pension is now in jeopardy. I remember the first time I had a chance to order a judgment book from our former unscrupulous warehouse company. That's the same company I made pay us back $50,000 for their so-called billing error that I, a clerk, exposed. When I first opened this book, volume number one, it took me back on a journey over 100 years to the clerks that had made the beautiful handwritten entries. The first entry date was April 28th, 1906, just 10 days after our devastating natural disaster known worldwide as the Great San Francisco Fire and Earthquake. She looks pretty good for 105 years old.
Mr. Lavarini, you have about 30 seconds, sir.
The eyes of the world are on us now. They're watching closely as we can pull together. Can we, unselfishly, to overcome this man-made disaster? I'm sure the uncertainty that faces me and my fellow clerks today can only pale in comparison to my predecessors. Please remember that all together we make up the judicial branch of California. The citizens voted once and eliminated the individual municipal courts. The good citizens can speak again, and who knows what they will demand of us. But surely, if we continue on the path to erode their civil rights, putting the rights of criminals before them, restricting their access to justice, this may be the last time I'll be able to speak before this civil body as we know it today. In the basement of my courthouse, on the door that separates my working space from the judge's garage, I wrote a sign. It reads, Civil Archives, serving the courts, serving the public, preserving our legal history. I can only hope now that it remains there and remains true after I'm gone.
Thank you, Mr. Lavarini. We appreciate your comments. Next, we have Judge Kevin McCormick.
Madam Chief Justice and members of the Judicial Council, I'm Kevin McCormick. I'm a judge with the Sacramento Superior Court, and I address you today in my capacity as one of the directors of the 400-member Alliance of California Judges. We're respectfully asking you to reconsider and reverse your decision, which allocates cuts in a manner that ensures court closures, compels layoff of staff critical to court operation, requires shortened court hours, and makes denial of access to the judiciary a certainty the public were in existence to serve. As a judiciary, we have a duty to carefully, prudently, responsibly, and thoughtfully spend the taxpayer money. We're required to take special care to ensure access to the courts is not denied to the citizens who pay for it. It is undeniable that the cuts of $350 million are difficult to distribute. It is challenging to decide which projects to forego, which building projects to delay, and how to prioritize valuable and important personnel. Nobody wants to make these horribly difficult decisions, but that is the financial reality in which we find ourselves. The President of the Alliance, Judge David Lampe, addressed you at the July meeting to ask you to fully mitigate the impact of the $350 million budget cuts to the trial courts this year. He explained at that time that there was approximately $82 million of additional mitigation available to the Council under the authority granted to it in this year's budget bill. We asked you to find these funds in CCMS budget and the AOC operating budget and utilize them to keep our trial courts open. As the Chief Justice and many of you have promised, that is your absolute first priority. We were not the only ones to make this request. San Francisco Presiding Judge Catherine Feinstein and Assistant Presiding Judge Lori Earle made very compelling cases for this position as well. Judge Feinstein pointed out the folly of continuing to fund a controversial and untested computer system at this time and to spend money on a bloated bureaucracy while at the same time forcing trial courts to close and depriving citizens of their constitutional right to their day in court. The choice before you last month was clear: cut the AOC budget and suspend funding of CCMS, or deprive citizens of their ability to access the courts. Unfortunately, Judge Pines and Judge Wesley were the only ones to come down on the side of the courts and its constituents. The rest of the Judicial Council acceded to the AOC's allocation proposal. What's extremely concerning about the allocation of these cuts is how the Judicial Council went about deciding how to apportion the cuts. With the most significant financial decision facing California's judiciary in its history, the decision was one made by recommendations of the AOC staff. There was no independent fiscal advisor. There was no auditor. There was no financial expert. There was no independent analysis. In fact, there was no consideration of further cuts toward the AOC as opposed to the courts themselves. To many, it seemed peculiar to leave the decision-making responsibility to the very bureaucracy that was criticized so completely in the state auditor's report, and who, of course, had a vested interest in protecting their own fiefdom. Based on this methodology, there was no option considered which looked carefully and thoughtfully at the size, the growth, and the appropriate scope of the duties originally contemplated for the AOC. There was no option presented which was designed to minimize the impact on the citizens who rely on the courts being open. In fact, the decision was made without any detailed analysis of the viable alternatives, like the one suggested by Judge Lampe and Presiding Judge Feinstein. There was no careful consideration of the size of the AOC, and recent events expose why. Perhaps it's because nobody even knows who works for the AOC. For over a month, I've been asking for a list of people paid by or through the AOC. Seemingly simple task. Easily compiled in any private company in the United States. One would think that an email list, HR department, information services division, executive office, office of general counsel, finance division, or at least somebody in a 1,000-plus person bureaucracy or their myriad of committees could supply a list of who earns an income for work done for the AOC. Over a month later, and in spite of assurances that the information would be provided by August 22nd, as of now, I still do not have the requested information. There is nothing that could more clearly cause legitimate concern that the AOC has grown beyond any concept of reasonableness than the fact that they can't even identify who works for them. Of course, there is one other thing. The CDAA provides training across the state for 5,200 prosecutors. They do that with a staff of 9. The educational staff of the AOC, which serves 1,700 judicial officers, 100 people. Branch leadership has convened a committee, the SEC, to conduct an in-depth review of the AOC and its organizational structure.
Judge McCormick, you have 30 seconds.
Thank you. The usefulness of such an evaluation is obvious, but it is inconceivable that proposals from this committee are not anticipated until the summer of 2012. Our financial situation is too severe to wait until a year from the committee's formation for proposals. The Chief Justice has many times been quoted as saying, "Keeping the courts open is the number one priority." These words are meaningless if the Judicial Council places administrative bureaucracy and failed projects such as CCMS with a higher priority than public access to justice. You need to act now to provide all available mitigation from all available sources, including additional reductions to the AOC and cessation of funding to CCMS to the courts to prevent closures and ensure public access. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge McCormick.
You're welcome.
Next, we'll hear from Mr. Chris Dolan.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, and members of this council.
Good morning.
I'm here today, although I'm a member of many statewide and local specialty bars as a private lawyer who represents clients. I do not speak today on behalf of those bodies, though I have been intimately involved with them over the years, and the budget issues. First, I want to thank you very much for your leadership, all of you, and for the time that you put in doing this work, many outside of your regular jobs, to see that we have access to justice. We have a financial crisis. I want to thank you for the reallocations that you made from your budgets, unselfishly, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, the AOC, to fund the trial courts. That has not gone unrecognized. I want to say that there is a voice that needs to be raised here, which is the voice of the clients, the people who are waiting outside the doors, the people who have a constitutional right to a jury trial. All of us. We swore to uphold and defend the Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That Constitution includes a right to a jury trial. It's a fundamental aspect of democracy. It can only be delivered through an open courthouse. I'm a San Francisco lawyer. There is a San Francisco crisis. There is a loud voice from San Francisco. There's a need in San Francisco. But this is not a San Francisco problem alone. And there cannot be only a San Francisco solution. And if I was here solely as a San Francisco lawyer, rather than someone who's supposed to uphold and defend the Constitution of the state, I would say treat us specially. Save us. But I have colleagues, friends, and clients in other jurisdictions that also need the same savior and opportunity. So that why I believe and hope that there can be a solution locally, it needs to be one that is statewide. And we cannot fraction. And I heard the words fiefdom. And that is exactly what we have to avoid. Because in fiefdoms, things can happen. And I have to tell you that myself, many of my clients and colleagues, we feel that we're in a hostage crisis. Day 30. What's being held hostage? The access to a jury. Why is it being held hostage? Political issues. Contest for funding. But that is not, I do not think, the role of judiciary. To create insecurity. It's to create calm and security. And to work together. It's interesting, I look at this room. It is a circle of judges throughout the state, legislators, who look inward. You don't point outward. And you look inward at the goal of preserving justice. And there are resources. There are resources available to keep our courts open now. And we can't close our courts now to try to keep them open a year from now. The impact of this crisis is already being affected to my clients. We are being denied fair opportunities for compensation because people literally are saying, you will not have a courtroom. You better take this money now or you'll get nothing. That is the reality. And these are people whose homes are being lost because they've been injured or fired. And they need this access to this jury trial. And the funds that this branch needs need to be kept intact through the judiciary and not to be swept for convenience. In closing, I would like to say that I hope that this crisis, this hostage crisis, can end. And I hope that there will be offers and compromise from both sides with whatever reserves are available. And that not only will an offer be made by both sides, but it will be accepted. Because the time for division has to end and the time for justice must continue. Thank you for your time and your commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. In addition to the comments we received publicly, we also received, and council has copies, of written comments received for today's meeting. The persons who provided those written comments are Mr. Stewart, who you heard from first in our public comment, but also Mr. Arnold Mednick, referee out of the Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, the Honorable Catherine Feinstein, presiding judge, Superior Court of California, County of San Francisco, and another written comment received by Mr. Sigfredo, also known as Fred Cabrera, on his own behalf, California taxpayers. According to our agenda, we are now at a time and place to consider approval of the minutes of our previous business meetings. Any discussion on our previous business meetings, or do I hear a motion?
So moved. Second.
Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Matter passes. Since our last meeting, it's an opportunity now to share several reports of activities occurring between the last meeting and now. It's my opportunity to give to you the Chief Justice's report. And I want to start off by describing that for many months I've conducted an earnest inquiry into the governance structures of the branch. Many of you are aware of that through surveys and through my meetings with you, your bench, and bar associations. We all know we are in a new area defined by limited resources and more leadership in the judicial branch by our judges and by our stakeholders. We've made many changes. We've experienced them here, but we have many more in the process. I recently formed three internal working groups that are members of council to assist me in a comprehensive review of branch governance structures and leadership. And I'd like to just describe very briefly for you a few here. First, we created the Working Group on Judicial Council Governance to address changes. Members of this group include all the members of the Executive and Planning Internal Committee of the Judicial Council, as well as Judge Sharon Waters and Judge Marianne O'Malley. Justice Miller has agreed to chair this group in addition to his duties as chair of ENP. You also know that the substance of some of the proposed changes came from our meeting here of judicial council members with three whiteboards and us discussing how we would like to see changes in judicial branch governance. Also, suggestions to the governance committee come from the presiding judges, trial court judges survey that was conducted in March that I received in May and have shared with ENP, not only the entire appendix of that survey, but as well as summaries of the survey. And as you know, those comments received from the survey pertaining to the AOC have been redirected to the SEC for their evaluation. So the survey is in use and part of our continuing dialogue. We also created the Working Group on Judicial Council Parliamentary Rules. I believe that was probably first initiated by Judge Rosenberg, when we had one of our meetings and had motion upon motion. And so we will have a developed set of rules of procedure for judicial council meetings. They will be based, I believe, on Robert's Rules of Order, but they will be simpler, easier to learn, and more user-friendly. And the proposed rules will handle such topics as establishing a quorum, handling motions, and counting votes. Justice Hull, Judge Jackson, Judge Pines, Judge Rosenberg, and Commissioner Alexander have agreed to serve on this very important committee. And Justice Hull will chair the group as part of his duties of chair of Rules and Projects Committee. Justice Hull has also agreed to chair the working group on the search for an administrative director. And for this critical assignment, I've also enlisted Justice Baxter, Judge So, Judge Baker, Judge Yu, and Judge Friedman, as well as Ms. Mathai, Ms. Turner, and my principal attorney, Ms. Beth Jay. You'll be hearing more about this later this morning. I'd also like to share with you our appearances and outreach I've made as chief and on behalf of the Judicial Council. First, in early July, I had the opportunity to visit with the justices of the Court of Appeal, 4th District in San Diego. And at the invitation of Judge Nadler and the Bar Association of Sonoma County, I visited the court in Santa Rosa with Justice Ming Chin before remarks at a bar luncheon. Also had the opportunity to visit at that time with Senator Evans, who was also at the reception, who's also present this morning. Thank you, Senator Evans. I've also visited with several local bar associations and legal groups. I'll share just a few. I met with the Oboda Barristers Club at a luncheon in Sacramento, the Vietnamese Bar Association of Northern California here in San Francisco, the Inland Empire Legal Association of Women in Riverside, One Justice, formerly known as the Public Interest Clearinghouse here in San Francisco, and Bill and Ron and I also traveled to Atlanta to attend the Conference of Chief Justices, as well as the Conference of State Court Administrators, a very interesting meeting across the nation, courts and commonwealths and territories. Courts are struggling with budget issues, and California's are monumental to the other states, primarily because of our numbers and our, when we say a cut of $350 million, that's in comparison to the fact that Guam's Chief Justice informs us that his budget is $12 million. So it is a matter of proportion, and California is always leading the way. I've given numerous media interviews to explain the impact of the budget reduction on the courts, and on July 8th, I was in Los Angeles and gave the keynote address at the town hall on the status of the branch. And finally, in the last several weeks, as many of you know, I hosted meetings with groups of bar leaders. No other justice or judge was present except Justice Baxter and I, and we discussed the branch budget and its impact on access to California statewide with leaders of the bar in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Riverside, San Diego. We hope to conduct the same with Central Valley leaders and bar associations. And a working group's been established to explore some of the proposed statewide solutions in more detail. And some of you here on council were also members of that group, and I thank you for taking on an additional responsibility as we look into trying to avoid dire straits in fiscal year 12-13 and to avoid any mid-year cuts in 11-12. Before I conclude my report, I think it's very important to recognize that this is the final business meeting for two extraordinary men. One is first, Ken Kahn. as you know, Ken, he sits quietly in the corner, but really guides us in all things and keeps us focused and on track. And it was a wealth of knowledge and information and common sense in a gray world of issues. And so, Ken, we recognize that you are an extraordinary person who really facilitates our meetings. We will miss you. We wish you well on your second chapter. But thank you for your service to Council and to the AOC.
You have a copy of my written report, and there's not much to add to that, so I'll leave that for you to review. I did want to point out for purposes of clarification that the recommendations that the council acted on the budget were the recommendations that came from the trial court budget working group, but as a result of the extraordinary times, also the that group supplemented by the administrator presiding justices, the clerk administrator of the California Supreme Court, who joined in joint session with the trial court budget working group and arrived at the recommendations that you considered at your meeting in allocating both reallocating funding and allocating the budget reductions, including the 12% reduction to the administrative office of the courts and the 9.7% to the appellate system, and then the 6.8% to the trial courts for this current year. In response to some of the issues facing courts that are affected disproportionately in the system to some extent because of either limited reserves in their budget to help supplement operations needs in the current year, and there were two in particular that were discussed at the budget working group and reviewed again after your motion at the last council meeting to examine reserves and other factors that may point to courts that will have challenges in the current year that may need assistance through the funding that is provided by statute, the 0.5% reserve that is held at the state level. And so based on that information, there are conversations that have taken place with both of the courts that are distinguishable in terms of extremely low reserves, and that was the San Francisco Superior Court and the Superior Court of San Joaquin. And so there are discussions that have been taking place with San Francisco and discussions that will be taking place with the Superior Court in San Joaquin County next Monday when our staff go down to visit with them and review the activities. So I'd like to call on Ron Overholt, who has taken time yesterday to follow up on numerous meetings that the Chief Justice has had with Presiding Judge Feinstein, that I've had with Presiding Judge Feinstein, as well as the meetings that we've had with representatives from various bar organizations in Northern and Southern California on these issues. And there are specific proposals that were discussed with Judge Feinstein to address the issues in the San Francisco Superior Court for the current year. So, Ron, if you wouldn't mind going over the nature of what the options were that were offered and the discussions that you've had.
Sure. Thank you, Bill. I'd be happy to. Before I do, though, let me just say on behalf of all of the staff of the AOC, Bill, how grateful we are for your service and what a privilege it's been to serve under your leadership and what you've done for the courts and the public and the AOC is remarkable, and your legacy will live on for a long, long time. So as Bill said, we're very keenly aware of the difficult situation that San Francisco is facing, the San Francisco Superior Court, and we've been in active discussions with the court and with the bar. Mary Roberts, Kurt Child, and I met with representatives of the BASF, Bar Association of San Francisco, on Monday for a couple of hours. We met Zlatko, our Finance Director, Kurt, Chad, Binky, Mary Roberts, and I met with Judge Feinstein and the Assistant PJ and Court Executive Michael Ewan for a couple of hours last Thursday. As Bill mentioned, I left the council yesterday for a period of time to go meet with Judge Feinstein and Michael Ewan to offer some alternatives that we believe are viable to offset the $6 million gap that exists in this year's budget. Those included use of the court's reserves to a certain extent, not entirely, but it does include use of the court's reserves below the 3% that we talked about yesterday. It includes accepting the funds from the mod fund for the complex litigation court, which was scheduled to be closed, and therefore the funding for the complex courts was going to be sent back to the mod fund. It included some potential additional revenue that I would ask your council to consider if we're able to move forward on this alternative plan. We talked yesterday about reserves and how that would be addressed and what the criteria would be, and that certainly is a discussion that we would have to have, but I included that in the alternative options that would be available potentially. And it included the court resuming cost-saving measures that were implemented last year at the San Francisco Superior Court, partially which is responsible for their ability to increase their reserves from $280,000 the previous year to $4.6 million as of June 30th of this year. And it also included recommendation that the court implement all of the items identified in the audit that was presented to this council earlier this summer. I was informed that they were moving forward on all of those items, but I think it would be important to follow up on that and make sure that if there's any assistance needed from the AOC or from the council, that be offered to make sure that that revenue is realized as well. I left it with Judge Feinstein and Michael Ewan yesterday to consider. I thought the meeting was very productive and cordial. It was a very good conversation. Judge Feinstein indicated to me that there was still great concern that the court has about future years, and the court was certainly hoping to have a three-year plan so that we don't sort of fall off the cliff that we talked about next year, if there are no mitigations to the kinds of budget cuts that are on tap, that next year would be very, very difficult, as would the following year. I suggested that as far as my thought is that it's worth the risk to not close the courts and lay off staff this year and work on a solution for next year and the year after, that a three-year guarantee or three-year plan is not available in the legislature or offered in the legislature, knowing there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we're sort of working on a year-to-year basis at this point, given the volatility of the economy. But in my view, that we have an option that would be able to close a $6 million gap this year, and that I believed it was worth the risk to accept that and move forward on it and continue to work on plans to mitigate further cuts next year. There was questions raised about, you know, why is there reason for hope that something might be done? I indicated that the actions of the Bar Association of San Francisco in terms of raising the issue to the legislature and the governor and to the Judicial Council was very useful and productive. And I think certainly with the announcement from Judge Edmund day before yesterday of the future problems that the L.A. Superior Court will be facing and other courts around the state that with the L.A. Bar and the consumer attorneys and various other groups raising the issue that it's not just the judges saying we need more money, but it is those folks who use the court system and represent the public that we have a problem and it needs to be addressed. And so while I'm not entirely resting on hope, I do believe that given the kinds of attention that's been raised and discussion that's taken place in the legislature will bear fruit next year, along with the efforts of the Chief Justice and all of us to go to the legislature and the governor and identify those problems going forward. So I'm waiting to hear back. I left it with the court and am currently trying to reach Judge Feinstein, but I think I'm hopeful that we'll be able to avoid the situation this year at least. And that's, you know, the concern is real that for Judge Feinstein and for Michael Ewan to have to issue potential layoff notices every year is unbearable for them, and I agree, and I understand that. But I think if there's a way to survive this year, that hopefully we will take that opportunity and work on next year.
Thank you, Ron. And then finally, often not discussed on the budget issues. Thank you again. Often not discussed on the budget issues are the budgets of the Supreme Court, the Courts of Appeal, the six districts of the Courts of Appeal, and the AOC Judicial Council budget. And so just as the trial courts, after you made your decisions, are taking steps to figure out the strategy that's most appropriate in their respective jurisdictions, so have our appellate courts and the appellate administrators doing the same thing. And we had a joint meeting with all of the APJs, the appellate administrators, the clerk administrator of the Supreme Court, and our staff. And a number of actions are being taken in each of the districts individually, but collectively in the state-level judicial system. The decision has been made to continue the furloughs that have been in place for the past 18 months in this process, or 2 years, and to continue those furloughs for a day a month for the next year again in that process. And within the AOC, Ron Overholt and several of our directors have acted as a committee for the review of the budgets and how we make the budget reductions during this year. And so some of the things that are reported on in here in terms of the consolidation of divisions based on retirements that are taking place, the potential elimination of a significant number of the positions based on the freeze that has been in place for the past 18 months, and a number of other steps that are being taken to reduce personnel positions and other cost-saving measures are the same types of activities that are taking place in each of the appellate districts. And I think, as was mentioned at your last meeting, the appellate courts and the Supreme Court, as well as the Judicial Council budgets, have not had money reallocated from other areas of the budget in the process. So for these reductions that they have had each year, they're having to find ways to permanently make reductions to the base cost of the operations as they move ahead in the process. So the challenges are there, not as dramatically as they are in our trial courts, but with the same risk and the same implications for the services to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Now from the Judicial Council Committee presentations, we'll hear from PCLC, Justice Baxter.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The Policy Coordination and Liaison Committee met on four occasions since my last report. Two meetings were strictly informational that dealt with the budget-related issues. At the June 29th meeting, the Policy Committee approved one legislative proposal for circulation as part of the spring cycle of invitations to comment, and also received an update on recent activities pertaining to the budget. The invitation to comment seeks public comment on legislation relating to the recognition of tribal court civil judgments. The information update to the committee included information on SB 87, the 2011-12 budget bill, and on Assembly Bills 109 and 117, the criminal justice realignment bills. The policy committee also welcomed Justice Ashman Gerst as its newest member, and welcome to you. And on July 29th, the policy committee received a budget update and voted to adopt the administrative presiding justice's advisory committee recommendation to enact a responsive filing fee for appeals and urge the governor to sign Assembly Bill 110, a budget trailer bill containing that fee and a few other judiciary items. Two of our council-sponsored bills have been signed into law, AB 458, relating to venue and guardianship proceedings, and Senate Bill 731, which streamlines the procedures governing vexatious litigants and improves the handling of judicial arbitration awards. Three other council-sponsored bills continue to move through the process. The legislature returned from summer recess on August 15th and is in the final push before the close of the 2011-12 legislative session. The last day of the session is September 9th, and the governor will have until October 9th to sign or veto bills sent to his desk. In closing, I want to express my personal thanks and appreciation to all of the members of the policy committee for their fine work during the course of the year, as well as to the staff of the Office of Governmental Affairs. The service we've received from Kurt, Donna, and that entire staff is absolutely outstanding. And that concludes my report, Chief.
Thank you, Justice Baxter. Justice Miller.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The Executive and Planning Committee has met.
I guess I'm new, too.
Contagious.
Thank you, Chief Justice, to start over. The Executive and Planning Committee has met seven times since the last council meeting on July 22nd. Three of those deliberations were by email, three by telephone, and an in-person meeting on August 24th. At our August 5th meeting, we set the agenda for the council's August meetings, the education meeting of yesterday and our business meeting for today. We also discussed the new open educational meeting and the expanded public comment portion of the business meetings and the processes we would follow in that regard. Now that our educational meetings are public, they will be audio cast as well as memorialized as official minutes of the council. As the chief has said, the panel discussions were extremely valuable, and I hope they will be taken advantage of by those who may benefit from them. That's why they're open. Beginning with this session, business meetings will open with an expanded and more liberal public comment period. Anyone wishing to address the council on any matter related to, specifically related to, judicial or court administration is invited to address the council at the start of its meeting. We've simplified the notification process to make it easier for prospective speakers to reserve time. Outside of public comment, we've revised our rules to allow judges, court administrators, and others who wish to speak on a topic on the agenda to address the council when it considers that proposal rather than at the start of the meeting. We value the comments we receive at public meetings, and we think that these changes will encourage greater participation and serve to enrich the discussion at the meetings. We believe and hope this will make council decisions and the decision-making process more transparent and informative. I want to thank staff for the assistance in quickly implementing these changes. None of us can be certain what the impact of expanded comment will be on the length or tone or content of our meetings, but we believe that council discussions can only benefit from increased access and greater input from affected and interested parties, and especially the public that the council exists to serve. At our August 5th meeting, the committee also reviewed recommendations from the Trial Court Facility Modification Working Group to approve budget for court facilities modification and planning for the current fiscal year and the prioritized list of facilities modifications. This matter is one of the items on our discussion agenda for today. The committee reviewed a request from the Access and Fairness Advisory Committee that the advisory committee be permitted to comment on a pending proposal to amend the canons of the Code of Judicial Ethics. The committee determined that per our governance policies, comment may not be made in the name of the council's advisory committee. However, the committee observed that the chair or members of the advisory committee may submit their comments as individuals and may state their role on the advisory committee. The committee reviewed a working draft of recommendations from Judicial Council members on roles, responsibilities, and processes for several areas of council functions: oversight of the AOC, branch planning, communication, outreach, council meetings, and advisory groups. The draft was the result of council discussion, a robust discussion, at our June planning session. The committee's review resulted in a number of recommendations to the Judicial Council, several of which I mentioned yesterday at our education meeting, and some which I want to repeat today. Also, though, please be aware that there are more proposals in the works, all inspired by council discussions and informed by the responses to the survey conducted by presiding judges at the request of the Chief Justice. And again, as I indicated, just for today's purposes, I will mention a few. Exploring more and frequent meetings of the council. The chief has considered proposed dates for 8 council meetings in 2012, 6 meetings of 2 or 3 days, similar to the current schedule, plus 2 additional 1-day meetings in January and July. For improving communications and outreach, we want to improve council outreach at regional meetings. These should be listening sessions in addition to informative sessions. Information needs to flow both ways. In other words, we want to provide information but also receive information that we can take back to the council. We plan to set up a network of Judicial Council member liaisons for each trial court, again, to facilitate communication between the council and the branch. Court leaders would have designated council members assigned to their individual trial courts. We would make visits, we would provide information, and we would listen to concerns and bring that back to the council. We also intend to set up Judicial Council member liaisons with AOC divisions and departments, again, to better understand the work of these important departments and divisions, to understand who the employees are, who the managers are, what their budget is, and then the council will report, that council member will report back to the Judicial Council to keep the council informed so it can better perform its oversight duties. For ensuring adequate oversight, we've asked the Advisory Committee on Financial Accountability and Efficiency to undertake an analysis of the AOC budget to formulate recommendations and report back to the council. We've also asked them to look at AOC contracts and consulting contracts and to formulate recommendations concerning adequate Judicial Council oversight, and again to report back to the council. Meanwhile, the Strategic Evaluation Committee that the chief appointed in March will continue its internal review and audit of the AOC. At our meeting on Monday, the committee approved the final agenda that is before our meeting today. The request by the Bar Association of San Francisco to add a proposal to amend Rule 10.815 to our discussion agenda was discussed in great detail, with one committee member voting against and another abstaining. Finally, at our meeting Wednesday, the committee reviewed nominations submitted for various advisory committee vacancies. We have submitted our recommendations to the chief. In essence, that concludes my report, but as chair of executive and planning, and on behalf of our committee members, we also want to thank Ken Kahn for the dedication, the conscientiousness, and the great advice that he has provided, I know, for many years, and especially for my first 6 weeks here. It will be difficult not having you there, although we are glad that you are going to enjoy your retirement. So thank you for all your years of service and what you've provided for us and for the branch. Thank you. And then I'd like to just make an offer to Bill. I know that we have this connection with Utah, and I want to offer that the next time we're together in Utah, that you go off on a nice, quiet stream with me, and we'll go fly fishing, but you can't bring your phone. Thank
That'll
you,
be Chief. Hard, but I'll do it.
Thank you, Justice Miller. We'll hear from Justice Hull.
Yes, thank you, Chief. Good morning, members of the council and ladies and gentlemen. The Rules and Projects Committee has met twice by telephone since the June 24th council meeting. On July 29th, RuPro met by telephone to review a proposal to implement the recent criminal justice realignment legislation to be circulated on a special cycle. Following circulation and further review by the Criminal Law Advisory Committee and RuPro, the proposal is expected to come before the council at a future business meeting. On August 23rd, RuPro met by telephone to continue discussing issues, concerns, and suggestions regarding improving the rulemaking process. In addition, RuPro communicated by email on one matter on August 18th. The committee considered a technical amendment to the uniform bail and penalty schedules, which is going to be item 5 on our agenda today, and I should note that RuPro recommends approval of this proposal. I should note also that I took the opportunity to attend a part of the August 16th, 2011 joint meeting of the Trial Court Presiding Judges Advisory Committee and the Court Executive Advisory Committee. At that time, Judge Suzanne Kingsbury and Ms. Mary Beth Todd and I were able to give a very brief overview of some of the ideas that RuPro has been discussing and will continue to discuss in upcoming meetings to improve the rulemaking process. I was able to speak to Judge Kingsbury and Ms. Todd and members of the RuPro staff on August 22nd so that they were able to give me a full picture of the rules issues that were discussed at the Presiding Justice Court Executive meeting during the time when I was not able to be there. All of that information that they gave to me was in turn conveyed to RuPro members during the telephonic conference on August the 23rd that I referred to a moment ago. I would like to note also the Chief Justice appointed me to chair the Rules and Projects Committee in July, and things have become very interesting very quickly. As I noted to the Presiding Judge's Court Executive meeting, RuPro has been considering and continues to consider significant changes in the rulemaking process with an emphasis on focusing on the effect of the economic struggles that the branch will continue to encounter. Our next RuPro meeting is set for September the 9th, and we have in excess of 50 rules and forms to consider. Given that number alone, and particularly in light of the economic impact the rules and forms can have on the day-to-day functioning of the courts, I've invited the chairpersons of our various advisory committees to participate in the meeting so that we can get their views of the necessity and the cost of the rules that are being proposed. We're going to want to talk about, among other things, whether the implementation of certain new rules can be delayed or whether they can be reduced in scope. RuPro is also discussing whether rules that are already in existence that are costly to the courts, again monetarily or in staff time, can be identified and perhaps suspended or even perhaps repealed given the branch's fiscal circumstances. RuPro will seek input from each of the 58 superior courts through their presiding judges and their court executives and from the appellate courts as well. In addition to cost savings, we will also be cognizant of the goal of giving individual courts appropriate flexibility in conducting their business in ways that best suit the needs of the public in their communities. Finally, we are taking a look at ways to relieve the burdens of twice-a-year proposals for many, many rules and are discussing whether we might establish 2 or 3-year cycles for considering proposals from the various advisory committees so that in any given year, absent an emergency need, RuPro and the council would be considering and the various parties interested in the rules would be commenting on proposed rules and forms from just 3 or 4 advisory committees each year instead of all of them every year. These are ambitious goals and demanding times, but I am confident that RuPro, the council, and the branch is up to the task that stands before us, and I would like to add my thanks to Ken Kahn and Bill Vickery, and I needn't repeat every good thing that has been said about them, but we are equally in their debt. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Justice Hull. Judge
Madam
Berman?
Chief, Yes.
I'm sorry. I wanted to ask a question of the last report from Executive and Planning, and it was...
Please do.
Thank you. Justice Miller, you had directed Accounting and Efficiency to report back to the Council on the AOC budget contracting activities. Was there a date or form of that report, oral, written?
It would be written, and we're working with the staff to figure out when they would be able to make that report back. We're hoping by October.
Thank you. Determined.
Thank you. On behalf of the interim committee, I'd endorse and incorporate by reference all the wonderful comments about Bill and about Ken Kahn. And Ken, I wish you luck with your bicycling career, Ken. So at any rate, it's my pleasure to report today on behalf of the CCMS internal committee within its charge oversight of CCMS coordination with the executive governance committee's committee of CCMS and reporting back to the council on CCMS as a project. I was struck yesterday by Alan Carlson's comments during our budget education period about the existing V3 version in Orange County and its ELF peripherals in terms of, number one, the savings that are being achieved in that court by this electronic process, this courthouse in a box, if you will, as well as what's equally important to the taxpayers, the litigants, and the stakeholders in our system, and that is tremendously increased and more convenient access to justice. Again, for those taxpayers, those litigants, our lawyers, who much appreciate the e-filing system and the e-access to court, the dockets and information, as well as litigants, self-help litigants, who also can, from throughout the state, have access and electronic interaction with your system, which is the future, we hope, of our IT project and our CCMS project here in the state. Since the last meeting, on behalf of the internal committee, I've attended weekly meetings with Justice Berniers, as well as with Deloitte, as well as with the IVV independent verification folks to monitor the project's progress towards the completion of development. Judge Kaufman and I have attended all of the telephonic executive committee meetings to keep up to speed with what's going on with the governance committees. We have held a telephonic meeting amongst our internal committee jointly with the executive committee to bring them up to speed on the completion of development as well as the independent review process. Today's report will update the council on, first of all, final budget projection for the CCMS completion of development, the summary results from the product acceptance testing, that is the testing that's been going on for the last throughout the life of the project, the next steps as we exit development and move into maintenance and implementation. And I'll thumbnail a few of these and then turn it over to Justice Berniers and Mark Moore to fill the council in on the details. As far as the testing of the product, the council is already aware, we completed the core CCMS product testing back in April of this year, and we're on track to complete testing of the externals, that is e-filing, data warehouse, et cetera, sometime today, I believe. The independent third-party review reports are in, and Justice Berniers will talk about those. That is, they're on the verge of finalization either today or early next week. Earlier this week, Justice Berniers and I, along with Glenn Reiser, attended Deloitte's final briefing of the product before the completion of most of the development phases. It was a very productive meeting. It's very interesting. For the last 4 years, at least, there have been product testers. Many of them are experienced clerks that are been provided by our courts, as well as retired clerks who have been testing the product, along with judges who have also been testing the product. It was a real experience to meet with those testers, and their work is almost done, but they really have been workhorses, and I just want to, on behalf of the internal committee, thank that staff, those folks who have been doing that testing of this product, And I would like to also thank Mark Moore, Mark Dusman, and the AOC staff who have worked very hard. This has been a very intense last phase of the development process. So with that, Justice Berniers.
Thank you. Good morning, Council members, Chief Justice. As Herman mentioned, he and I attended the weekly project meeting with Deloitte at their offices in Santa Ana on Wednesday of this week, both to ensure that we were up to speed on the project status and to personally thank the court-based testing teams who've really given so much time and effort and contributed their expertise to successful completion of this project. We also had our follow-up weekly conference call with Deloitte this morning. I am very pleased to tell you that with one single exception that I will talk about in a moment, we are there. We have successfully completed all of the development activities for CCMS. We have a product that I think we can be proud of and that will do what we need it to do in the branch. As you've heard, and most of you recall, certainly, we completed the testing of the core product in April of this year. And the core product represents all of the functionality supporting the court operations, case initiation, calendaring, minute orders, fees, fines, those sorts of things. Our acceptance criteria under our contract with Deloitte was what we refer to as 0050. That is, zero level one defects, zero level two defects, no more than 50 level three defects, those things which we've referred to as kind of punch list items. We finished that phase at 0034 and accepted the core product. We began the external component testing toward the end of June. The external components represent the additional features and functions that augment the CCMS core product. We have 121 data exchanges with our justice partners, deals with the web portal, e-filing, and the state data warehouse, among other things. As of this morning, we can report that we have a final defect count of 0013. That is, we have met the contract criteria. And I would point out, too, that this is this is a cumulative total going forward from the core product as well. So those 34 defects that were listed in at the core acceptance have been repaired, have been fixed. We have a total, cumulative total of 13 level 3 defects at this point, again, with the single exception of our GPSIS reports. One of the things we discovered as we were going through the testing process and we were having issues, there are 13 GPSIS reports which are currently generated at the trial court level and which will be generated automatically from the data warehouse in CCMS. And as we discovered some issues with those, what we determined was that the product design, the product specifications, were to the 2004 GPSIS standards and GPSIS requirements. Since that time, GPSIS has been changed. There is a 2009 GPSIS standard which has been developed, and our testing was to the 2009 standard. So not surprisingly, we had some disconnects and some defects there. To avoid having that delay the rest of the project and to avoid having it divert resources from completing the product acceptance testing, we carved that out and decided to put that on a separate track. So there is a separate track that will target completion of this single narrow issue, these GPSIS reports, by the end of October. Excuse me. We expect to have product acceptance testing for those issues perhaps the last 2 weeks in October. Hopefully we will have it completed before we come back here for the October council meeting. But with that exception, every other component, every other piece of this has successfully completed the product acceptance testing.
I might just add, Justice Berniers, from an educational standpoint, that when we're talking about the level of quote-unquote defects, that is punch list defects, we're talking about a system that has 6 million lines of code and 20,000 test scripts, the test scripts being the scripts that the experienced clerical staff from courts throughout the state run through the system on a test basis to make sure that the system is doing what it's supposed to do. And so that's been an intense and valuable process for us. And the fact that we are here with this level, low level of defect is impressive. I mean, everyone that has gone through a beta processes with computers knows that it's an intense process, and this is a successful result. So thank you.
Well, the testing process has involved six courts: Fresno, Los Angeles, Orange County, Sacramento, San Diego, and Ventura. It involved 80 testers, including court-based subject matter experts, clerks, retired clerks, AOC staff, as well as professional testers. We also brought 11 of our justice partners into the testing process: Department of Motor Vehicles, Department of Justice, Department of Child Support Services, CHP, State Bar, at least one of the e-filing vendors. We did the testing in multiple locations at Burbank, Sacramento, Fresno, San Francisco, Santa Ana, and Ventura. As Judge Herman mentioned, I think we have something like 20,000 test scripts that are designed to ensure compliance with approximately 5,000, I believe, user-defined requirements that are incorporated into CCMS. In addition to the product acceptance testing, we've been running stress testing in operating environments for both the core product and for the external components. The stress tests are designed to ensure that the applications perform under anticipated peak volumes, both internal and external court user volumes. So far in that testing, CCMS has met or exceeded our service level requirements. We began the judicial officer testing yesterday. We had hoped to be able to start that earlier, but we've started with the judicial officer testing yesterday. I have to say we did have a couple glitches in the system configuration, so we need to reset that and bring the judicial officers back in to make sure that we have a system that meets operating needs on a day-to-day basis in every court. So we had, I think, four judicial officers in yesterday from a couple different courts. We'll be bringing them back in and hopefully getting some additional judicial officer testing as well. And I'll be able to report to you at our October meeting on the results of those tests.
excuse me, Justice Berniers, let me just ask quickly. I know this has been referred to before, but when you refer to now 13 level 3 defects, could you give us some idea of what types of defects those are?
Mark, can you focus on what some of those were? Because, frankly, I couldn't tell you individually what they are.
No, I just mean generally what we're talking about here, how significant they are.
Sure. So a level 3 defect would be the type of defect that would, in your normal course of business, cause some disruption to your operation, but you can mitigate it, usually through a workaround, a step that you wouldn't want to take, or bypassing a step, but it doesn't. The criteria for it to be a 3 is that it cannot delay your workflow or create a line or a bottleneck in your organization, and it cannot reduce the integrity of the data. So they're really kind of workarounds, things you wouldn't want to go for a prolonged period of time, but it wouldn't prevent you from actually deploying in production. So any one of these defects, you would still make a go, no-go decision. You would still say go and implement CCMS in production.
And I would point out that Deloitte's commitment within our existing contract parameters is to repair all of these defects. In other words, we're not going to go forward in deployment with those defects in place. They will repair at no other cost to us, and within the current contract parameters, all level 3 defects and as well as all level 4 defects. So all of those will be taken care of before we begin any deployment in the trial court.
Very well. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I would We will have a more detailed report for you at the meeting, but I can also tell you that our CCMS development costs will come in at $315.5 million. That's actually about $3.6 million less than the last amount we reported to the legislature due to some cost savings that have been implemented in the program. In addition to our acceptance testing of the product, the independent quality review, which both the council and the legislature have required that we do, has has been completed. We had hoped that we would have the reports available for you today. We do not have the final reports. We should have them probably the first part of next week, certainly before the end of the month, which is the deliverable date for both of the vendors. I did meet, or Mark and I did meet yesterday with one of the vendors for our final review session with them. This is a two-part review process. One part of this is a review of Deloitte's development methodology as measured against an industry standard, which is set by the Software Engineering Institute that is known as CMMI. It's a capability and maturity model integration, and they are required to be at a level 3. This the review is conducted using a process known as SCAMPI. It's Standard CMMI Appraisal Method for Process Improvement. It's a method to benchmark the quality ratings relative to the Software Engineering Institute CMMI models. The review done was what's referred to as a SCAMPI A, which is the most rigorous of the three evaluation models can be that can be used. The second review was done on the CCMS application code, the design development documentation, the test scripts, and the test results. While SCAMPI focuses on the development process, the code review focuses on the final CCMS product and the quality of that product. Again, according to the in accordance with the BSA recommendations, we hired different vendors for each of these reviews. We worked with the California Technology Agency and the BSA on the RFP for the vendors and the statement of work for both of the engagements. Independent Systems Diagnostics performed the SCAMPI review. K3 performed the independent code quality review. Both vendors started their work on June 20th, and as I said, we should have their reports in hand. All of their evaluation work is done. We'll have the reports in hand, and we'll have them for distribution to you sometime next week. In addition to distributing the reports to the council, to the governance committees, we will also provide them to the legislature, to the California Technology Agency, to the BSA, and we will post them publicly on our website. Each of these reports will provide detailed recommendations on what we can do and what Deloitte can do to improve our processes and to ensure the maintainability of CCMS going forward. Deloitte and the Project Management Office will create action plans to address each of the recommendations contained in these reports. And Mark has already asked me to ask the Governance Committee for authority to retain an independent consultant to participate in the development and review of our action plan. Again, we should have the action plan for you by the October meeting. The at the October meeting, we will intend to go over those reports with you, and we'll bring representatives from K3 and also from ISD, if the council wishes to hear from them as well, to participate in the review. As I mentioned, we had our last review meeting with K3 yesterday morning, and while we won't have the final report until early next week, K3 did confirm to me at that meeting their conclusion that the CCMS application, and this is using their words, is built on a solid, scalable foundation, and that CCMS will perform as designed when implemented into a production environment. So, bottom line is that we have a working product that meets the requirements that we have established for it. We have third-party confirmation that the product is of sound quality and will work for us. And now we need to find a way to put it to work. Next steps that we still have to complete under our contract with Deloitte, we do need to complete the work on the GPSIS reports. As I said, that will be done by the time we come back here. We need to initiate the completion of or the repair of the Level 3 and Level 4 severity defects. There are some changes in the CCMS fiscal reports that have been recommended by the Operations Advisory Committee. These are changes to the original design, but in other words, enhanced functionality that the Operations Advisory Committee has recommended we implement. We do need to expand and complete our judicial officer testing and to optimize the application environment. We have some minor functionality changes that the court-based testers had recommended based on their experience during the testing of CCMS. And, again, Deloitte has agreed to do all of this work and as part of their original contract without any additional cost to us. We do intend to come back to you in October, not only with a final report on these issues, but with some detailed recommendations on what we can do within our existing budget constraints to put CCMS to work, get it to the trial courts that do need it, to perhaps leverage some of the resources that local courts that have needs can offer, and to move on to the next step and in this critical project.
And the internal committee will be meeting jointly with the executive committee to develop what the council has requested us to come back with in terms of strategies within the existing budget framework. So that will be our internal committee's intense work between now and when we come back in October.
Thank you. Judge Fiennes.
As you've heard me say before, I've been concerned about the cost of this project. I appreciate that we're going to be considering this further in October. But as I understand it, the AOC is going to be submitting a budget request for next year's budget to the Governor's Office, Department of Finance, in September. Mark, how much is being requested in next year's budget for CCMS?
Well, I don't think we have an official request yet for anything for next year, but
We're going to be dealing with this later in the agenda. Maybe we need someone for finance, but are you asking for the same amount or more than was requested for this year?
So according to the it was originally referred to as the one year pause. We're now relabeling it. It's not necessarily a 1 year pause. Hold on a second, and I'll get you. We actually forecasted what we'd need for 3 years going out, and we presented that at the last session. 1 second.
Well, while you're looking at that,
I've got it. It's 74.5 million.
That's what's being requested in next year's budget. That's what you'd be asking the council to approve now.
That's the original forecast based upon what we know now. Before we consider the work that we're working with the internal committee to figure out how to refactor the deployments and the work efforts based upon the reductions this year.
And that's one of the things we had said we would do, Judge Pines, is try to reevaluate deployment strategies, see what we could do to further minimize and reduce the costs, not just associated with the deployment of CCMS, the final version, but also with our interim versions in Fresno and Orange County, San Diego, and others. So we have ongoing costs incorporated that we have to deal with V2 and V3 that we need to either mitigate or reduce. We need to find a deployment strategy going forward that will at least substantially reduce the costs that we will be incurring.
No, I appreciate that. It would also be helpful to me, at least, for the later discussion, if we're going to be dealing with this in October, is to have some other alternatives. I mean, if we decide we really cannot afford CCMS as it's presently envisioned, while at the same time keeping the courthouse doors open in the next fiscal year, because from everything I can see, for example, in Los Angeles, we're going to be able to get by pretty much this year because of all the one-year stopgap measures, but we're facing a real cliff next year. We've got San Francisco. Hopefully this problem can be resolved this year through this compromise that's on the table now, but I know that they're going to have greater problems next year, and so it is for all the courts. So if we reach the decision that we really cannot afford CCMS as it's presently being planned, it'd be helpful for me to see some other options, whether pieces of that can be used. For example, in our civil department, we don't have e-filing, and I hear all the wonderful aspects that exist in Orange County. It sounds great. Can that be something that can be broken off in a sense, and I'm not using the right words, and available for Los Angeles at a much reduced cost, or other pieces of this that can be used? I'd like to see some other options rather than an all-or-nothing scenario.
And that's what we've been discussing and will be discussing. As a matter of fact, we have an in-person meeting, tentatively scheduled at least, for both the Executive Committee and the Internal Committee of the Council for September 23rd. And the entire focus of that meeting will be on, one, seeing what we could do within existing budget constraints on the early adopter deployment, so we get the system out in a live court environment during the warranty period, and two, look at alternative deployment strategies, including, and we've been discussing, modular deployment of CCMS, so that if a court, for example, has a critical need for criminal traffic, they could take that piece of the system, that a court could implement civil and the document management and the e-filing components separately from the rest of the system. So those are all options that are going to be up for discussion, up for consideration, and will be among the choices we'll be coming back to the council with. I think we need to look at what the cost impacts would be on each of those alternatives.
And if I could, before we go on, just a little bit more clarification on that number I gave you. That was inclusive of the entire CCMS program, including the two precursor systems. CCMS itself, the end product, would be $55 million. And it is important to note, and that's why our activities over the next month or so are so important. When we implemented a one-year pause, that assumed a very drastic reduction or kind of turn down of the entire program, and then a very large cost to sort of re-engage next year and the year after. I expect one of the benefits of trying to figure out a different way to factor in and go forward is we won't have such a steep drawdown, which will really save us, I'm hoping, on the back end, because it's very inefficient to sort of unplug and then restart. So I'm hoping that'll level out the expenses. But we need to work through that in the model.
I just wanted to note that although that started out as a one-year pause, when it was actually the vote of the council was that the cost that would be equal to a one-year pause, right, would be that those monies would be given up, but it would not, the remaining monies could be used as was found to be appropriate, so that it didn't have to be an actual pause, depending upon what was determined after that meeting.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just add one more thing, Judge Pines. We did, as part of our outreach through the governance committees, we've been giving demonstrations of the final product throughout the state with impressive reactions from our judicial colleagues. Judge Reeser and I recently did a presentation a couple of weeks ago at the Judicial College for new judges who are coming into our system, many of them from civil practice and diverse practices, diverse judges from throughout the state. And I believe we had five or six of your colleagues from Los Angeles. Mark Marmorow was one of them. I know him because we had cases together back when. And they were all extremely favorably disposed towards what CCMS can do for our courts. So
I understand. The issue for me is whether we can afford it and what our priorities are.
Yeah, absolutely. Understood, and I think that's exactly where we're going in terms of coming back to the council in October.
Thank you. Alan Carlson.
Are we going to include on our analysis about the cost this next year? What's the cost to the trial courts who have to put in new systems because CCMS didn't come yet, like Nevada and Sonoma and some other people?
Well, and I know there are counties like Kings that has an immediate need coming up as well. I think that's certainly one of the factors we have to consider in assessing what our, you know, what we can afford to spend on CCMS is what we are spending now and putting Band-Aids on or providing interim replacements for failing systems. There's certainly a number of courts that are in that situation. I would just like to, you know, finally say recognize the truly amazing effort that Mark Moore and his staff have made for this effort. I don't think it's any secret that a year and a half ago, early 2010, you know, we had problems and issues with CCMS and issues that certainly could have been fatal to this system and to this process. And Mark put together his PMO staff. I think clearly in retrospect, it's a process that we should have initiated earlier than we did. But he stepped in, got it up to speed, and the dedication and diligence of Mark and his staff have been absolutely essential to getting this done. We would not be where we are today without the effort that Mark and his staff have contributed to this.
Thank you, Jeff.
I would just add, I've already mentioned that tremendous effort, but I would just also add the governance committees. These putting together the governance committees was an outstanding way to make sure that we've got judicial and CEO involvement and ownership of this project, and they have put in tremendous work in terms of bringing us forward and bringing us to where we are today.
Thank you, Justice Breniers, for that and for the presentation. Thank you, Mark Moore, and thank you, Judge Herman.
Thank you.
And to my understanding, no member has asked for the matters to be removed from the consent agenda, so items 1 through 5 are adopted.